Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 145, recorded Sunday, October 7th, 2018. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. It's a bit of a food episode on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast. Two topics, restaurant karma and hotel breakfasts. Coming to you today from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, after 3 weeks of, let's call it normal travel. No vacation travel, no international travel, just a couple of trips down to Charlottesville, Virginia that sort of sandwiched a quick shot down to Dallas, and no delays, and empty seats beside me. Indeed, I even scored an upgrade on the late night United flight from Dulles to O'Hare, which was the long leg of one of my flights home from Charlottesville. I don't know. It feels like we're at the start of, maybe a 6 week travel lull between, call it the final end of summer vacations and early starts of Thanksgiving travel. Now, there was a bit of drama around the Charlottesville trip in the middle of September, kind of that first trip. I had to fly out Sunday night, and that was the weekend that Hurricane Florence hit the Carolina coast. The storm track forecast had Florence sort of plowing west, you know, kind of through the Carolinas and then taking a right turn at, call it the Appalachians, and then heading north over Virginia. So the question for me, when would it make the turn? Would my Sunday flight make it through before or after the turn? Or would Florence be kind of in my way on the on that Sunday? So Thursday night, Friday, I spent a good bit of time hitting the refresh button on the National Hurricane Center's website. By Friday, Florence had dropped a couple of category levels, slowed down, and then by Saturday, I could see my Sunday flight would beat Florence to Charlottesville. So actually, it was a very smooth flight that Sunday night, though I got to tell you, Monday was just a bit wet. Going through TSA pre-check in O'Hare that Sunday night, I watched a guy use what I guess was the electronic boarding pass app, maybe the United app, on his Apple Watch. Or I don't know, maybe it was the wallet version on the Apple Watch. It looked a bit awkward. And if you think about it, it's understandable. Boarding pass readers face up. You put your boarding pass or phone face down on them to read. But a watch is face up on the top of your wrist. So the guy ended up kind of standing on his toes and twisting his arm around to get his Apple Watch face down on the reader. I don't know, you'd think that he would have sort of shifted to his phone after that, but I saw him again twist himself up about 30 minutes later when boarding his flight. It seems like it would have been just easier to spin the watch on his wrist so that it was facing down. I don't know, at least until Apple fires up the old Steve Jobs distortion field to convince airports to reorient all their readers for the convenience of Apple Watch users. So following up, Alan Marco, a longtime listener and even longer time friend, sent me an article that dove into an interesting part of Apple's new partnership with Salesforce, Salesforce.com, the CRM cloud provider. The two of the companies, are working with Marriott to put Siri in hotel rooms. Now, you could ask Siri, I guess, to turn up the heat, order room service, or get an Uber all through an Apple HomePod that would be in each hotel room. I mean, that's Apple's piece of the partnership. The Salesforce piece lets Siri remember what you asked her, say, you know, what your room temperature was, and then have it available for the next Marriott room, whether at that hotel or another property. I don't know, useful or creepy? And how do you make sure that you wipe Siri's memory or the HomePod's memory before the next guest checks into the room so you can't ask her things like, hey, Siri, tell me about the last guest who was here, or, I don't know, order me the same sandwich the last guy ordered. I don't even like using these new NCO TVs to log into my own Netflix account, let alone having Marriott listening to me through a HomePod and remembering everything I mutter. Some guys are making a nice living selling kind of shutters that you can stick over your laptop webcam. Are earplugs for hotel HomePods the next thing? In the last episode, I mentioned flying SAS from Chicago to Copenhagen. It was an odd schedule, leaving Chicago about 10 p.m. and then arriving Copenhagen about 1 in the afternoon the next afternoon. So pushing back that late and then having a long taxi to the runway, I fell asleep before we left the ground and before putting my phone in airplane mode. I woke up, about an hour or so later, looked at my phone for the time and noticed some new emails. So like, well, that's weird. And then I noticed that my phone didn't say no service. It was connected to some cellular service, which turned out to be SAS's in-flight cellular service. And as opposed to in-flight Wi-Fi, which you usually have to sort of log into, my iPhone had automatically started roaming on the SAS cellular service and then continued to check and pull email for, the couple of hours that I was asleep until I flipped it into airplane mode. I got my AT&T mobile bill a couple of weeks back and saw that I ended up with about $25 in roaming charges for what were sort of a half dozen meaningless emails. It was a pain, but not too painful, unlike the guy 4 years ago who rang up a $1,200 Wi-Fi bill on Sing Air when he fell asleep with his data still connected. Now, the third leg of that trip, going from Brussels to Edinburgh, our best option was KLM through Amsterdam. Now, I've been in and out and through Schiphol Airport a number of times over the past sort of 20-some-odd years, and I've always liked that airport. It's nothing flashy, but it works. It's not too big. It's got reasonable facilities. So booking this Brussels to Edinburgh trip on the KLM website, I had two options, a tight 40-minute connection or a two-hour one. Now, I don't mind Schiphol, but I wasn't looking to make an afternoon of it. We had things we had to do back at St. Andrews. So I broke one of my cardinal travel rules, never book a connection shorter than an hour. And I booked the 40-minute connection, knowing that we had a backup, though, if it didn't work out. Now, one factor I didn't completely think through that might have changed my mind was that we'd have to cross the Schengen border during that 40-minute connection. So, the first leg, Brussels to Amsterdam, was within the Schengen zone, so it was just like a domestic U.S. flight. No passport control, no customs. But in Schiphol, we had to switch concourses and then go through passport control because the U.K. is outside of Schengen, and not customs, but passport. We made it through, though, actually with time to spare because, well, we walked real fast. And like I said before, Schiphol isn't that big, so switching concourses wasn't a long walk. But more importantly, my wife spotted the short connection line at passport control. We'd gotten in the regular line, but then we saw on a display screen that our Edinburgh flight was classified a short connection. So we switched over to a much shorter line. I ended up earning a hey from a security guard when I ducked under the tape. And then we were actually able to quickly pass through what was a well-staffed and brisk passport control line. Munich Airport, you could take a couple of lessons here. We get to the gate with more than enough time. Boarding hadn't even been called yet. And so while we made the 40-minute connection, the question now was, would the checked luggage make it? And as we're queuing to board, I look out the terminal window. There's our plane. And there, next to the baggage loader, was Irene's and Claire's luggage. Stationary, not rolling along in that YouTube video. And I could tell because of the colors of the luggage. A very good sign. They were there physically, our bags were. But there wasn't anybody loading the luggage. So as I walk up to board, I tap one of the KLM guys standing around, pointing out the window. I say, hey, you see those bags on the tarmac? Those are ours. It would be like really great if they made it onto the plane. The guy just laughed, him a bit more than me. But I was happy to see them appear on the Edinburgh baggage carousel. Thanks very much, KLM. But this trip also got me thinking, though, that I think another carry-on bag, something that's between my sort of maximum legal size 22-incher and then my leather duffel overnighter. On that Brussels to Edinburgh trip, I carried my 22-incher on, but not without agents at Brussels and Amsterdam challenging me even after I showed them that it fit in their baggage sizer. Now, a few weeks after that trip, KLM added an augmented reality baggage sizer to their iPhone app. So if you fire up the app, you're supposed to be able to point your iPhone camera at your bag, and then the app overlays, it looks like a kind of a properly sized rectangle over your bag. And if your bag is within the rectangle, then you're good to go. I got to tell you, I wish that AR app had been in place while I was going on this KLM trip. Would have been easier and definitely much cooler than slamming my bag into those metal sizers. But I don't know, somehow with those gate agents, I just don't think the outcome would have been any different. Okay, one last thing from that trip. The concierge lounges in both the Copenhagen Marriott and the London St. Pancras Renaissance had prominent rule signs at the lounge doors. And one of those rules was a ban on fitness clothes. Now, this wasn't a big deal on this trip because I was on vacation and I wasn't toting workout gear. But my normal hotel program when I'm on business travel is to get up before 6, work out, go straight to the lounge in my fitness gear for some breakfast while cooling down, then head back to my room to shower, change, and head out. Having to separate the cool down from breakfast would add, I don't know, probably about 15 to 20 minutes, but to what is already kind of a tight morning routine. So I got to tell you, I hope this rule, this ban on fitness clothes, doesn't spread to the U.S. lounges. Now, the rest of the rules seem pretty reasonable, though. One, no wearing a bathrobe in the lounge. That seemed a little superfluous. I've never seen, you know, somebody walk into a concierge lounge in a bathrobe until in Copenhagen at 3 o'clock in the afternoon with it not looking like there was anything on under that robe. So I got to tell you, I'm now completely on board with the no robe rule. Hey, and if you have any travel questions, a story, a comment, travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address, comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. You can send in an audio comment, a Twitter message to M. Peacock, post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page or the Instagram account at Travel Commons, or you can always go old school, post those thoughts on the website, an actual website, at travelcommons.com. First topic on this food edition of the Travel Commons podcast is restaurant karma. Casey Milch sent me a note a few weeks back. Greetings. Love the podcast. I know you mentioned frequent trips to Charlottesville, and I'm finding myself there every 6 weeks for work myself now. Any restaurant suggestions? So one of the compensations kind of for getting on an airplane just about every week is that you get to try a lot of restaurants. Now, in the last episode, we talked about the downside of that, rapid waistline expansion. But if you're thoughtful about it and you like trying different food, and I gotta tell you though, I hate the word foodie, business travel has its benefits. So I ended up sending Casey a few recommendations from my what's been now a couple of years in Charlottesville. Fitzroy, kind of a meat place, burgers, double pork chop, fried chicken sandwiches on the Main Street pedestrian mall. Lampo, a small Neapolitan pizza place with a big wood oven that is, and I forgot to tell Casey this, a 5-minute walk from the Champion Brewing Company's tap room. And then the Alley Light, a speakeasy in a small alcove, which I think it's a bit too short to be called a proper alley, with no sign, though there is a light over the door, and it took us 3 times to find it the first time I was there, and it was in pouring rain, which led us to the existential question, how many consultants does it take to work Google Maps? Putting the list together for Casey reminded me that we hadn't been to Alley Light in a while, so we went there, actually ate there last Tuesday night, found it the first time, though, and had roasted bone marrow, pork rillette, duck confit. Oh, we did have some carrots, too. So much for thoughtfulness. Now, Charlottesville punches above its weight for good restaurants. I don't know, maybe because of University of Virginia is there. The 2.5 years I spent in New Orleans was definitely one of my food high points, especially when crawfish were in season. 3 months in Portland, Oregon was fun with the food truck scene. And of course, it's sort of ground zero for the craft beer explosion. Stays in Manhattan, San Francisco, London, I got to tell you, were that much more enjoyable with somebody else picking up the dinner tab. Indeed, in San Francisco, I used to stay in different hotels in different neighborhoods so I could try different neighborhood joints. But you know, karma always seeks a balance. And for all these great food locations, there have been other, let's say, less than stunning places. Dover, Ohio, about 30 miles south of Canton, had, when I was doing a project there, it really had, there were only two places to eat, an Arby's and the lunch counter of a Walmart knockoff. And I got to tell you, the Walmart knockoff was the better of the two. Oldsmar, Florida was just a bit too far outside of Tampa for us to head in for dinner. So the nearby Buffalo Wild Wings, B-Dubs, and Applebee's honestly were the best shots there. And downtown Detroit in the early 2000s, working, eating, and sleeping in the urban fortress that is the Renaissance Center was just brutally monotonous. But, you know, even in London and New York, we weren't splurging on big meals every night. We have reasonable expense budgets that we have to live within. So, again, we find balance. One night we're underspending at a dive to get, you know, good pizza by the slice, but it's a dive joint and it's relatively cheap so that the next night we're eating at a really nice place. Now, some guys actually will even extend this balancing act to travel, sucking up the inconvenience of a cheaper connecting flight to be able to pay for better meals. One colleague told me, "I'll happily fly cheap to eat great food." The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is hotel breakfasts. You know, growing up, those of us of a certain age heard that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Usually we heard that from a cereal commercial in between the Saturday morning cartoons. I mentioned a bit earlier my morning hotel pattern: work out, hit the concierge lounge for breakfast, then get on with my day. Now, I have to tell you, most lounge breakfasts are pretty industrial. They're just kind of serviceable. Chafing dishes of stiff, scrambled, pasteurized eggs, thin slices of oven-baked bacon, kind of a vat of oatmeal, a few cartons of yogurt, and a bowl of fruit. It gets the day started. Though I may be judging it a bit harshly, my daughter Claire loves those scrambled eggs. Don't know why. Go a bit more upscale and, you know, maybe you see a platter of smoked salmon, some sliced meats, cheeses, bran muffins. So I can tell you, though, when I see something different, it gets my attention, like the roasted green chilies in New Mexico, Albuquerque and Santa Fe to season those scrambled eggs, or the king cake at the Canal Street Sheraton in New Orleans during Mardi Gras season. Now, I have to tell you, it's not the best king cake I've had. My wife has dragged me through a king cake tasting crawl there in New Orleans, so I speak with some knowledge. But I got to tell you, I look forward to it whenever I'm there in the spring. I remember one morning I walked in, no king cake. I found one of the staff. I said, "Hey, you guys stopped doing king cake?" And the guy said, "No, I didn't know we were out." He immediately brought out a new one. Crisis averted. And you know what? It doesn't even have to be anything big. I mean, the Copenhagen Marriott Lounge had rhubarb juice. Now, as a kid, my mother made pies from rhubarb growing in our backyard that I think her mother had planted. But it was something different and nostalgic all in one. Was it life-changing? No, not necessarily, but I'd never seen it before. Now, a little more life-changing was the bowl of Bunbo Hui that we got for breakfast when staying at a local non-chain hotel in Hue in central Vietnam, kind of spicier, funkier than the pho that you see here in the U.S., and certainly tougher to find here, but it was not like any hotel breakfast I'd had before, and I immediately switched my breakfast choice over to it, the Bunbo Hui or pho, if I couldn't get it, for the rest of the trip. It was great. And actually, back in May, when I was in Pune, we stayed at a Marriott Courtyard, a chain which, as I've complained before in prior episodes, doesn't have a concierge lounge. But at this place in Pune, they had a nice breakfast buffet with what I guess is kind of the typical two-track system. One side of the buffet has the usual Western breakfast foods, eggs, bacon, sausage, stuff like that. And then the other side kind of is all Indian food. So the waiter pointed me over to the omelet station, and I was about ready to order sort of a regular omelet when I noticed another station just sort of to my right that looked like it had kind of like this supersized crepe griddle. I looked over, it looked at the guy standing behind us. What's that? He's like, oh, it's to make doses. I'm like, cool, I'll have one. Do you know what a dose is? No, but I'll take it, whatever it is and however it normally comes. So I watched the guy make this sort of foot wide in diameter, stiff crepe, kind of rolled it up slightly, and he put it kind of sticking straight up out of a cup of some sort of stew or curry. I walk back to the table with it. Everyone else who I'm traveling with has sort of eggs, bacon, toast, all arranged horizontally on their plate. I'm the only one with a vertical breakfast, but I kind of liked it. Kind of like flying the flag for something different at breakfast. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 145. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Check out the show notes for music links, as always. And now, actually, you can find us on a new place on Spotify. So Spotify used to just kind of only have curated podcasts, but actually, last week, they opened it. I think it's a beta program where you could submit your RSS feed. So I immediately submitted Travel Commons to Spotify. And now if you search in Spotify for Travel Commons, it should pop up. It worked for me. And there's actually a link to the Travel Commons page in Spotify in the end of the show notes. So now you can find us on Spotify. And always before, you could find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn. You can always ask Alexa to play Travel Commons. We'll play the most recent episode. And then, as always, iTunes. And hey, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file, comment, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, and Peacock on Twitter, the Travel Commons Facebook page, the Travel Commons Instagram site, post them on the website at travelcommons.com. A lot of places that you can come talk to us. No, thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, and post comments on the website. It's helpful. I really appreciate it. Love to hear from you guys. And until the next time, safe travels. Thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.